Welcome to Canada's most irreverent talk show. This is The Andrew Lawton Show, brought to you by True North.
Hello and welcome to you all, Canada's most irreverent talk show, The Andrew Lawton Show here on True North, coming to you live from the Westin, Ottawa, the exhibit hall for the Canada Strong and Free Network's annual conference, the flagship conference for the conservative movement. We have, as we were talking about yesterday, lots of people from all across the country and, in fact, all around the world that have descended on this otherwise blasé and bland city, but we've been pepping it up a little bit in the course of the last couple of days. We're on day two of the conference. Things have really gotten going now. And I will say I thoroughly enjoyed last night. The panel discussion was a discussion with Tony Abbott, the former Prime Minister of Australia, who will be on this show tomorrow, and Boris Johnson, the former Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, who did not respond to our invitations to come on the show. And they were in a great dialogue moderated by John O'Sullivan, who will be joining us in just about 25 minutes or so, the former advisor to Lady Thatcher in the UK, also the author of a number of books, but one I particularly love called The President, the Pope, and the Prime Minister, about three very courageous and principled figures who worked together to vanquish communism. So we'll talk about that with John O'Sullivan a little later on in the show. One of the many debates that I think is raging in the conservative movement right now, and even at this conference, has been what's happening to Canadian cities. It's great to talk about crime in the abstract and talk about criminal law and all of these things that are in the federal domain, but much of these challenges begin at home, and I think have reared their heads in very ugly ways at the local level. It used to be we could look at Vancouver and say, oh yeah, tent cities, permissive drug laws, that's the place and it's only there. But within the span of, I'd say, a decade, we've seen this problem balloon to communities across this country. Small towns, large cities, they all seem to have their own share of these increasing homelessness and addiction problems, and what goes along with that but crime issues. Well, one guy who tried to clean up the biggest city in Canada, Toronto, was Anthony Fury, who you may have heard of. He was a vice president at True North until he decided to set his sights on municipal office, and we'll talk about whether he perhaps plans to try that again. But Anthony Fury is with us. It's great to have you back on True North, Anthony. Thank you.
It's good to be here. I haven't seen you in a while. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing great.
We did this at a CSFN a couple of years back, and you, of course, have gone on to politics. I'm still here with the microphone and the camera. But you set out to do something very ambitious. You had never been elected before. You did, for a first-time candidate, I think, tremendously well. Let me ask you, first and foremost, why you did that. Well, because you've had a platform in the Toronto Sun and at True North to talk about these issues. Why did you want to go at it from that political direction?
Because the issues that I had been vocalizing for months leading up were issues that I knew people wanted to see addressed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'd spent so much airtime on air, on radio, and out about my columns saying, we got to deal with these problems, and here is the opportunity to bring about these solutions. So it was a real from the heart, we got to turn this city around. I'm really concerned about this. Community guy, and I have three small kids at home. You know, we write our columns on federal politics and so forth, but people may not realize, wait, this is a guy in a city who's deeply passionate about these issues in my daily life, what my neighbors had been telling me. My wife and I would go and walk around the neighborhood, and we'd just hear from neighbors who were feeling so downtrodden about the state of the city on a number of these points. You know, Andrew, people talking about, I want to leave Toronto, I want to leave this city. Oh, this isn't what it used to be. And it was heartbreaking to me because I grew up in Toronto. I'm a Toronto kid, a great teen years, university years, roaming about the city, and it's not the same. And I looked at the options out there, and I said, someone's got to step forward, and I felt it was me. And I had the time of a life. It was an amazing experience, and I loved every minute of it, advocating for those policies that we need for cities.
There are these stereotypes that exist of cities. Like, I remember the first time I went to San Francisco, which was 2018. Everyone had given me this, like, horrendously, you know, almost cartoonish image of what San Francisco was. And then I was there.
Mandatory oat milk lattes.
They were. Well, but I meant on terms of the street situation. And literally outside my hotel, I've arrived there. There's a homeless person's, you know, feces on the sidewalk in front of me. Sorry for those of you in the lunch hour. But Toronto has become like this in a lot of ways. Like, I spoke to someone last week who, you know, drives around normally, but they took their child on a streetcar for the first time in however long. And literally, this one time, their first foray into public transit, a homeless guy is waving around a knife. Like, waving around a knife. And these are stories that have become not isolated incidents. These are stories that have become the norm. People that are terrified of taking public transit in Toronto, people that are terrified of being out. I mean, when did this become a problem, and can you diagnose the why?
So back in around the 1980s, great North American cities in the U.S. and Canada faced great decline, the American cities more so. These periods are cyclical. That's coming back rather tragically. And we're seeing this in a lot of American cities. We're seeing in Vancouver, we're seeing in Toronto, in Ottawa, and other Canadian cities to some respects. And we need to bring in those common sense policies that go back to basics, prioritize the core services people need, and prioritize the public safety issues. Things that we saw in New York decades ago that saw it turned around, and we're getting to that point. And my warning during the last mayor's race was we need to stop the decline, and we need to act now to stop it from worsening. I didn't want to see it getting worse. Unfortunately, those indicators have worsened. People are looking, though, for some uplifting solutions. People feel really downbeat, Andrew, right now. As you said, they're not feeling it anymore. And isn't that so tragic? And I think that the pendulum has shifted such that center-right solutions are the ones that people want, even if they don't know it's that label, but they want to go in that direction to turn their cities around. And here's we have a great opportunity and a great period of momentum to make that happen in cities all across Canada. And I think people in the conservative movement should be excited about the winds of change on the federal level, but should also see that there are great opportunities at the municipal level where people's daily lives are most touched. And I'm an optimist on all of that, that we're going to bring about that change because we've got to. Because, you know, if Toronto fails, if Vancouver fails, Calgary fails, Canada fails.
Well, and on that note, I think it's an important point here because municipal politics, at least in Ontario, is not tainted by partisanship generally. And that's not to say there aren't candidates that are known to be Liberals or New Democrats or whatever. But so there are people that would vote for what you and I would call a small C conservative position on crime that would never identify as conservative and might actually be put off from voting with that if they knew it was a quote-unquote conservative policy. I had a discussion with someone the other day, very anti-conservative, doesn't like Pierre Poilievre, doesn't like Danielle Smith. That we were talking about it in an Alberta context. But my goodness, when you heard what they wanted to have happen on their streets, I'm like, you're rhyming off what would be a conservative platform on this issue. So it's not a partisan problem, I think, which is probably a bit encouraging for people in the municipal space.
Absolutely. You've nailed it. And that's why I say people want center-right solutions, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be ticking off conservative on ballot box. Although we are seeing there's a lot of young people and demographics who were previously liberal who will be voting for Pierre Poilievre. Absolutely. But the opportunity on the municipal level is you're standing up for a vision. Mm-hmm. So you can have, because there's not a party system, there can be a transaction for that election where you acknowledge, well, guys, you're seeing that we need these center-right policies, so come on board for this time and let's forge a coalition of everybody other than the radical leftists.
So explain to me that aspect, because I think most people would look at Toronto and say this is a left-wing city. The election of Olivia Chow, I think, kind of endorses that position.
We'll talk about that in a moment.
Not to make this about Israel, we can talk about it if you'd like. I do think that the Israel issues and the anti-Semitism have sort of exposed a lot of the problems with when you give the far left free rein on things. But I'll ask you about whether people are getting more engaged on this issue that are not even political, because we certainly see at the federal level people that are not political that are coming into the system. Municipal has always been the most difficult area to get voter turnout. So how's that unfolding?
100%. I actually have met with a number of business owners, community members recently all across the city of Toronto who say that they've never been in politics before. Mm-hmm. Maybe they vote, sometimes they don't vote, but they're just so concerned about what they're seeing that they feel they now need to get in the game. And that's really heartening. And maybe it's someone who says, oh, I was on the sidelines and I thought I was a liberal. I say, it doesn't matter, you know, who you voted for in the past, where you're going.
Yeah.
You bring that big coalition together. And when there are moments when people feel that their lives are really negatively affected, that's when they want to get involved in politics. You know, it's like the old saying, oh, is a low turnout rate that big of a deal? Sometimes it just means people are totally happy and satisfied.
Yeah.
Fine. But I think now we're seeing all across Canada, people are not happy. And more people are getting in the game than ever before, and that's a good thing.
Well, one of the challenges, too, and you mentioned earlier people leaving Toronto, is that there are people of means that can just say, you know what, I work from home, I can just, you know, go out to some, you know, five-bedroom place in King City. And who's left? It's the people that are the most affected by these problems, the people that rely on public transit, that don't have that sort of mobility or that sort of income. And it makes the problems worse, but it lets the elite people just sort of say it's not my problem anymore.
And the elite people take the money out, which erodes the tax base.
And to be fair, I'm not faulting people that want to make a decision for their family to move out of the city. I'm just saying
they're moving out of the city, the province. They're going to Florida. They're going. Yeah. There's an exodus from Ontario to Alberta.
It creates and furthers a problem when they do that.
No, it absolutely does, which is why we need to have a strong economy in our city. One thing I found remarkable, Andrew, during the last mayor's race, you know, at provincial and federal campaigns, they're always talking about growing the economy, as they should. They're talking about it nonstop. And I realized at a certain moment during the debates and the events we were doing, I thought, there are really no candidates talking about growing the local economy. It's almost as if they don't acknowledge it's a thing.
They only want it in the abstract, like grand national level?
Didn't even really acknowledge there's such a thing as a vibrant local economy, and there needs to be, because all these social services that we talk about needing to get people off of drugs, not further enabling the addiction, but get them off of drugs, help all these people on the street who are also causing the violence, so you help them, it's good for them, it's good for the rest of us, our families. To have those resources to do it, you need a strong tax base. You're going to keep the taxes low, but you need that tax base.
Yeah.
And if all these businesses and business leaders are saying, you know what, I'm not feeling anymore, I'm getting out of town, nothing's left anymore. Nothing's left. And how you can't look after the most vulnerable. I mean, you can't share the wealth unless you first grow the wealth.
So I almost, and I was talking about this earlier today with New Brunswick Premier Blaine Higgs, in that Vancouver has done a great service to people like you in cities that aren't Vancouver, in that they've showed what happens if you do everything that the activists want, and the failure of that. And I'm wondering if in Toronto, which probably would have had people that were more sympathetic to what Vancouver's been advocating, if you were to ask them a decade ago or even 5 years ago, if seeing Vancouver and what's happened in that city actually helps this argument in Toronto when you're saying, just look over there. Do you want to be like that?
You know, it's rather tragic that Aaron Gunn can make a documentary called Vancouver is Dying, and no one really objects to the headline. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, fair assessment. I mean, isn't that tragic? And we're seeing that more with our cities. I'm really concerned that there's a lot of activism from the far left that just wants to downplay and ignore basic reality. But the good news is, well, the unfortunate news, because it's necessary, Instagram and other online forums, they're pushing that out there, and people are seeing these horrendous scenes on the streets of Vancouver. You do not want your city going in that direction.
Yeah.
What got your city in that direction? Those policies. Now, in the U.S., Andrew, we have a number of Democrat politicians who are already pivoting. They're smart politicians, so they know, like in San Francisco and so forth, that mayor, she is pivoting. She was a left-wing mayor, and now she's suddenly kind of not as re-election comes around.
The Democrats have found this newfound tough-on-crime
However we get the good results for our families that we need, so we are seeing those changes, and they're going to happen, and I'm committed to still bringing those changes about in the city of Toronto.
It's the old Milton Friedman line I've talked about on the show in the past, where, you know, it's not about getting the right politicians elected. It's about making it so that the wrong politicians do the right thing. And then, I mean, in your case, we wanted the right politician elected. But here, even these terrible politicians are realizing this inescapable reality. And I think voters should just not let themselves be deluded into thinking that these problems weren't caused or exacerbated by these people.
Absolutely. I mean, nothing would make me happier than we vote in some left-wing politician and they're actually not all that bad. And you go, oh, great. Then you know, we don't have to feel that we need to run for office to replace them or whatnot and go and let them do their thing. Unfortunately, Andrew, that's not the direction. Unfortunately, our cities continue to decline, and conservatives and center-right people and people in the big blue tent movement need to get in the game at the municipal level as well. That's where the action is at. That is where our daily lives are most affected.
No, it's always been said by people smarter than me that the way you affect change is running for council, running for school board. I mean, these are the most imminent and immediate ways to do it. I know you've taken on a new role with the Frank Stronach Initiative on an economic charter, and we spoke about that in a great interview with Frank Stronach some months back. But are you taking another kick of the can?
I think that's highly likely, Andrew.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll keep an eye out for that. Anthony Fury, former True North VP of Editorial, former Toronto mayoral candidate. Great to see you again,
Anthony.
Thanks very much. All right. See, it's always good to catch up with an old colleague of mine. But thanks again to Anthony for coming on the show. And I think we'll have more coverage on this idea of what's happening to Canadian cities, what's happening. I shouldn't even just say cities. It's Canadian cities, towns, communities, villages, hamlets. All of them, to some extent, are dealing with this. And I think if you were to talk to most people and ask them what their number one issue is, they're going to say cost of living, affordability. Crime will not be far behind that. In fact, in some cases, in some communities, crime might be the top of the list. And what's fascinating is that when the federal government decides to talk about crime and justice issues, it's always looking in the worst direction possible. If I may be so bold as to say, or perhaps irreverent to say, the dumbest direction possible. This is what we've seen time and time again on firearms. You have gun crime, people being gunned down in the city streets of Toronto, and the government says, maybe Grandpa Joe shouldn't be able to have that hunting rifle anymore. So it was in that vein that I caught up earlier today with Tracy Wilson from the Canadian Coalition for Firearm Rights. And it's always wonderful to catch up with, from the Canadian Coalition for Firearm Rights, the wonderful Tracy Wilson. Tracy, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, Andrew. Thanks for the opportunity. I'm having a great time here.
So there are, you know, millions of gun owners in Canada. I think most of them tend to be maybe not partisan capital C conservatives, but at the very least, they are people that have great reasons to be frustrated with the federal Liberals. But there are millions and millions of conservatives in Canada who are not necessarily gun owners. And I wanted to talk to you about that group, because first off, is it generally speaking something that you can take for granted that people on the right in the country, when you talk about gun rights, are on your side?
Well, no, actually you can't. And for that matter, I think gun owners, first of all, have been forced to become conservative supporters. You've got a lot of left-leaning gun owners who may have supported other parties before, but the Liberals have kind of backed them into a corner. At the same time, you've got conservatives. I've been in many Twitter spaces and other venues where you have conversations and you hear conservatives even talking about, you know, maybe throwing gun owners under the bus. Maybe that policy is too complex or too politically risky. You know, maybe we don't need gun owners. And it's discouraging, because what it shows is that the Liberals have done a really good job in their messaging of trying to create a parallel between legal RCMP-vetted Canadian gun owners and criminals, where one does not exist.
One of the big issues that I think will be front and center for Canadians in the upcoming election is crime. This is an issue that's ravaging Canadian cities, not just drug and addiction, but all the property crime that goes along with it. The Liberals have tried to make it out as though their efforts to seize guns from law-abiding gun owners are going after criminals. And it's not even going after gun criminals, let alone crime in general. But how do you have that discussion on this issue when there is so much, to be frank, misinformation about that link between lawful regulated gun ownership and crime on Canadian city streets?
Well, I think that what we've got here is we've got 9 years of data on the Liberal policy on public safety. And unfortunately, it's been a tragic and bloody failure. So we see violent crime rates rising. At the same time, you know, you've got a government that's been focused solely on targeting licensed RCMP vetted gun owners, and also simultaneously passing legislation that softens or lessens the crimes, the sentences for some very serious gun crimes like C5 and C75. This is a serious problem, because when you have a government that is really tough on gun owners, but really soft on crime, you know, I'm not trying to wear a tinfoil hat here, but it's almost like it's an intentional thing. Like, they're going to use that increase in crime to continue with their ideological agenda against gun owners.
The challenge is that politics are always going to be downstream of culture and downstream of society. When politicians talk about an issue, they're really trying to capitalize on existing perceptions and existing misconceptions. And I think on the gun issue, Canadians that don't understand guns, don't know about guns, it's very easy to prey on those people and say, we're going to take assault weapons off the street and stuff like that. So how do you win the argument? Because I know education has become a big part of what the CCF does, but you also run up against resistance from journalists that don't understand these issues or are biased against you. And when you're trying to get your message out, it's just not getting out to people that need to see it.
Yeah, I think as a gun owner, I'm a middle-aged grandma from the suburbs, but I've been a gun owner for almost 30 years. And I think we've made a fatal mistake. The CCFR is pretty young. You know, we were born in 2015, sort of out of the liberal win. But I think we made a tragic mistake as a failure as a community for 30 years before that. We suffer from bad branding, because we were kind of taught, you know, keep your head down, keep quiet about your sport, don't talk about it, maybe you won't be noticed. And the problem is, there are, you know, middle-of-the-road Canadians who don't even know we own handguns or AR-15s, let alone support it. So a big initiative that the CCFR started a couple of years ago, which is coming up right around the corner, is National Range Day. It's the first Saturday in June every year, June 1st this year, and that's a day where ranges and clubs across the country open their doors to average Canadians to come in, see what it's all about, get a little education, and, you know, if nothing else, go away with a different perspective.
All right. And generally speaking, is your view that when someone has a gun in their hands, they're a convert?
Well, I mean, if they don't become a gun owner, at least they stop supporting bad Liberal policy. Me, I think every Canadian should become a licensed gun owner. Why not?
Well, I also think every journalist should go through the firearm safety course so they understand what comes along with it. And certainly,
politicians, too.
Yeah, we should pass a law, actually. If you want to vote on any firearms legislation, you have to have gone through the firearm safety course. Let's get behind that.
Yeah, I did a parliamentary e-petition on exactly that, and, of course, it was shut down.
Yeah, well, par for the course. All right, Tracy Wilson, thanks for your work, and as always, good to see you in person finally.
Yeah, you too, Andrew. Thanks a lot.
There might be a little bit of polarization on the firearms issue, but one thing I can say is that if you're talking to Canadian conservatives, and I mean that with a capital C and a small c, you're going to find the closest thing there is to a universal position is that we need to support the Canadian oil and gas sector, the Canadian energy industry. Now, what supporting that means is a bit different depending on who you talk to, and certainly there are contentious issues about things like the carbon tax, which has become one of the most galvanizing for the federal conservatives right now. But I wanted to talk about that core essence of what energy security means in Canada, and also at a time when energy is becoming more and more unaffordable, in part because of inflationary pressures, and also, yes, the carbon tax, what that actually means for Canada and the Canadian economy. So very pleased to have joining me on the show right now, Shannon Joseph, who is from Energy for a Secure Future. Shannon, great to have you on the show. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about that security aspect, because we often hear energy discussed in the political realm and the environmental realm. And what does it mean to talk about this in a security context?
So, you know, I think when most countries think about energy security, they're thinking, do I have access to energy? Is it affordable? Mm-hmm. Will it be resilient if it goes out? Those are the fundamentals. And do we have a system that keeps us safe? You know, this past January, when they almost lost power in Alberta when it was minus 41, that was a safety issue, it was a security issue. So I think that's kind of a baseline for the way people kind of intuitively react. Now, of course, in the world, it becomes a big security question when you don't have your own domestic energy mm-hmm. and you're relying on other countries to supply you. And I think a lot of countries were very strongly impacted when Russia invaded Ukraine. They found themselves on one side of the conflict, mm-hmm. but then on the other hand, they were still customers of Russian energy and have been seeking to get out from under that. So there are different layers. There's like a domestic lens and a local lens, international lens, but it's about people having the things they need to live.
Well, and that therein lies the problem of how Canada can not just do more for its own energy security, but also for the security of our allies. And that's why Germany is an exceptional example of this. When they say, yes, we'd love to buy Canadian LNG, and our government says there's no business case, and then Germany has had to look at other sources for this. Like, this is an obvious and a preventable problem. And I guess that's the part that I find so frustrating here, is that the only barrier is government policy.
I think an important barrier has been the whole way that we've approached the issue of environment and climate change. A lot of countries look at this with a real box around the country. And mm-hmm. it's like, how do we get down Canada's emissions? Or how do we get down
the 1.7% of global emissions that Canada is responsible for? You could cut to zero and you haven't saved the planet.
That's right. And that's because of the way the international policy is framed. And mm-hmm. I think there's a push more and more to take a global perspective. And when you open up that global perspective, then you realize that if Canada got our LNG to other countries, it could take a huge cut out of the emissions globally, way more than if Canada went to zero. Mm-hmm. And not only would it do that, but it would support reconciliation in Canada because Indigenous peoples are owners in these projects now. It would create wealth here because people need jobs, and some of these are the biggest jobs that are available to unions and other workers. And so there's a big value proposition for Canada to take a step back, mm-hmm. take a global approach to energy and environment, frankly, and that would be good for everyone.
When you find that you're doing your work, which is domestic, but also to some extent international, is Canada making that case? Is Canada even at the table, or is it really falling on organizations like yours to go around the world and say, hey, we could be a part of this solution?
I think there's just been a lot of... I think Canada's been operating within the box that was created for us by the Paris Agreement, which is a real country-by-country box. And I think the last 2 years with that Ukrainian conflict, with the inflation in energy prices, with the scramble scramble of countries mm-hmm. like Germany, Japan, and others trying to get other sources of supply, we finally started to have a conversation in Canada about looking at this differently. I don't know if all parts of government are ready to go there yet, but I think the more that ordinary people, workers, Indigenous leaders, farmers talk about the need for this bigger picture, the more we're going to get there as a country.
Let's just talk about reality here in terms of the political system in Canada. Conservatives are doing very well in the polls right now. You have a very pro-energy agenda that's been put forward, notwithstanding we haven't seen specifics from Pierre Poilievre. If he were to come in, or there were to be a different government, just to not push you into a partisan role here, how are we going to be still dealing with the consequences of not acting on this sooner? Like, how long would it take, even if you had a very aggressive pro-agenda federal government agenda that were to come in and say, yes, let the pipelines go, build it all? Like, how long would it take to actually scale up to a point where Canada can do what it wants to do or what you want it to do?
Yeah, so I mean, there have been times when we've missed the window, mm-hmm. and the United States got in there, and now they're the number one producer in the world. But the good news is today, Canada has LNG Canada that's almost done. We have the Coastal GasLink pipeline that's mechanically done. We have Cedar LNG that had a great announcement. So we have a lot of projects that are moving forward, and customers can mm-hmm. see they're moving forward. If we had a government that said, we want this industry to grow, and this is part of our strategy for helping the world with security, with environmental goals, with energy and affordability locally in those countries, then the investment community could say, okay, we can have confidence to invest in Canada, in phase two of LNG Canada, and in other projects that we haven't even been talking about yet.
Yeah.
These signals actually are really important, and I think that's an easy thing for a new government to do.
So I take from this that you remain more of an optimist than some other people in this space are. You see, I mean, because most people say there's all this stuff we could do. You're saying, look, there are things that we are doing right now. We're not totally left out of this.
Right. Well, I mean, one must remain optimistic. Otherwise, you don't get anything done.
What's the point? No one would take your meetings if you were going in and you said, oh, it's all done. What's the point of this?
But the reality is we are finally at a point where some of these projects are coming to completion. Mm-hmm. And there is an opportunity to do more. And the customers are ready. And that's a nice convergence. And so will we take advantage of that? We'll see. But the good news is the moment is here, and we can. And there's a broader base than ever that support that, including the Indigenous leaders I was talking about.
Yeah, and we're going to speak in just a few moments with Stephen Buffalo on this from the Indian Resource Council. I guess the one question I'd ask you would be about investor confidence. Like, do you think a lot of that can be recaptured? Companies that have said it's too precarious, I don't know if I want to do business in Canada. Do you think those people can be re-engaged?
Absolutely. I mean, people will re-engage if they believe that if they invest, they have a good chance of return, and that they can predict what's going to happen. They can predict the regulatory process. They can mm-hmm. predict that things will stick once a decision is made. And I think with all the different kind of pieces coming into place outside of the regulatory process, let's say, I think people will look. They want to believe in Canada. I hear that from places, you know, you're a rule of law country and that kind of thing. Okay, now we'll have a chance to show it. I think they'll come back.
All right. Well, there's that rosy picture we all needed as we engage on this issue. You never know. Sometimes you get the doom and gloom scenario from people on this. But I do want to throw to a conversation I had earlier today with Stephen Buffalo. He is the president of the Indian Resource Council and has been really front and center at pushing this idea that energy development is not anti-Indigenous. In fact, it's one of the most pro-Indigenous policies you can champion in Canada. Here's that discussion from earlier today.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Joining me is the president of the Indian Resource Council, Stephen Buffalo. Stephen, great to talk to you. Thanks for sitting down with us today.
Thanks for having me today.
I'll go for the guns here, because you have in Canada this narrative that we have in the media that Indigenous people are anti-energy and that the oil industry is anti-Indigenous. Now, you've been doing so much work to push back against that, but where does that, I'll say, false perception come from?
You know, obviously, through the years, First Nations have embraced this energy sector in Western Canada. And primarily, it is a driver to really wean ourselves away from federal dependency through the Indian Act. And of course, it's been a strong driver for a lot of our community development, education, and then we'd be able to address some of the needs of our community. This activism, obviously we want to protect Mother Earth for sure, but you know, having responsible development is key. And I think there's some outside forces really coming to intervene, get involved in our communities, and really push that envelope of environmental protection in the wrong way. You know, they don't speak for us, you know, these environmental groups. The nations have a voice, and it's really up to the leaders of the nation to decide. But ultimately, I think, you know, there's some foreign interference, as we heard before. You know, a good friend of ours, Dr. Vivian Krause, you know, she kind of opened her eyes to what the intrusion that's coming into yes. Canada and in our communities.
One of the things that you've touched on there, which I think is actually quite an important issue, is that you do have a lot of these American-funded environmental groups that really try to appropriate Indigenous causes in Canada. And you know, Indigenous people, I've heard, actually I think I might have heard you say it on a panel last year or 2 years ago, they're almost used as pawns in this, when most people are just saying, yeah, I want to be able to develop this resource that's in our community.
Absolutely. You know, unfortunately, some of our communities are in despair, mm-hmm. a lot of poverty. And when someone tells you, listen, I'll give you $300 to go protest this pipeline for today. You know, it sounds like a pretty sweet deal if you're just going there to hold a placard and kind of scream out some false pretexts. But, you know, that's just the reality of some of the areas that we're in and some of the issues that we face. Having an ability to make $300 for a day is sometimes a good thing but it is the wrong message, you know, and that's kind of what I want to say, is that it yeah. doesn't represent our true meaning behind this.
So the long game, though, is that if you do develop these sectors, it's a heck of a lot more than $300 that people are getting. Now, not every Indigenous community has access to, you know, oil and gas reserves, but for the ones that do, what does that trajectory look like? What is actually available to them if they do develop?
Well, you know, definitely there's big opportunities. There's entrepreneurship. There's jobs. You know, there's business relationship with the proponent, development of service companies, the list goes on and on. And quite honestly, some of the Indigenous services are now expanding, you know, where there's a huge jump into reclamation. Mm-hmm. It's pretty hard to see any further exploration and production on First Nation land, only because the land is all we have.
Yeah.
So reclaiming is a big thing. So there's a lot of jobs and a lot of opportunity for our people to show that not only, one, we can develop the resource responsibly, and two, we can definitely take care of Mother Earth when we're all finished.
So in that sense, the oil and gas sector and developing it and that economic opportunity can be a part of this reconciliation process that we hear governments talk about a lot of the time and often pay lip service to.
Absolutely. You know, true reclamation, you know, back in Alberta, we had a site reclamation program and we're period six. We spent over $131 million not IRC, but the nations of Alberta spent $131 million reclaiming their land. And we utilized a lot of the community members, their services, their equipment, everything like that. I think it was very positive. It was a well good spend. You know, people don't know what First Nation land is regulated differently. There are regulators in Indian Oil and Gas Canada, and unfortunately, they've been asleep at the wheel for the last 25 years. They don't. I think there's 39 litigations against Indian Oil and Gas Canada from different communities, and it's just, we have to do it ourselves. And I think we proved that through that whole program. We're hoping to do more of it. Our province in Alberta, the province is still sitting on $132 million left over from that reclamation program. Mm-hmm. And this came from COVID we're hoping that the First Nation can utilize it to continue the reclamation, because we need the land. We need to build houses. We have developments that we want to do in our communities, but we can't do it when there's abandoned pipelines, abandoned wells just in the background, right? So very important. And of course, you know, again, our First Nation communities have proved that we can do it if given a chance, because it's right in our backyard and we have to take care of it.
Stephen Buffalo, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the questions that are facing attendees here at the Canada Strong and Free Networking Conference are mostly of a domestic nature, but occasionally we can look to our friends and colleagues abroad for best practices, things to do, and in many cases, things not to do. I referenced earlier the rather lively discussion between Tony Abbott and Boris Johnson, which was moderated by the always convivial John O'Sullivan, who joins me here today. John, great to see you. Thanks very much for coming on.
Very good to see you, Andrew. Nice to be back together again.
Now, you're not just some foreign interloper in Canadian politics. You actually have a Canadian connection by way of the National Post.
Yes, I lived in Canada for 3 years, almost four, helping to launch the Post with, you know, under Conrad, its founder and owner, and under Ken White, who was a brilliant editor, and
Give Ken a plug there.
Well, I think Ken is the most brilliant editor in North America, and I'm always amazed why he hasn't been lured down to take over the failing enterprises there and give them some vim, you know. But yeah.
Yeah. So you've obviously, by virtue of being involved in the National Post, you've seen actually some of the critical steps in the development of the modern Canadian conservative movement. I mean, Canada, as you're well aware, has obviously taken its cues from the old British Tory tradition. But we also had this Western populist revolutionary party that has really, I think, become the senior partner in this merger with the current conservatives. And I was wondering if you could situate that in a global context, because there seems to be a shift in conservative parties around the world, not even just in the Anglosphere, that is moving towards what, you know, the media would call, you know, the far right populist view, but it's a lot more nuanced than that.
Well, yes, it's much more nuanced than that. I would say that the conservatives throughout the world are now a divided group, divided parties or divided into two different parties. That was the situation of Canadian conservatives back in the, I'm trying to think of the dates now, but something like in the 80s and later. Now, what happened in that case was that two very brilliant entrepreneurs, Preston Manning, who started Reform, and Stephen Harper, essentially campaigned against the Brian Mulroney's Conservative Party. Mulroney had actually very serious achievements to his credit, but he'd lost touch, really, I think, with the conservative rank and file, outside Ontario and to the west. So, you know, that led to the complete implosion of the Conservative Party here, which, by the way, is likely to happen, maybe not quite so dramatically, to the British Tories now. And so looking at the, so to speak, wreckage, Harper and Manning created a party of which combined the conservatives of the East with the reformers of the West. I don't think, populism is a misleading term in my view, because it tends to be the view of the left about the democracy of the right. And essentially what Harper and Manning did was to create a new conservative party that represented the conservative voters of the entire country. And that's not a majority party, but it is now, in the last two elections. It gets most votes, more votes than any other single party. And it is plainly destined, I think. Only a huge traffic accident can prevent the Conservatives winning the next election. And that means that they will have been in power a significant part of this new century. And I think that they are a serious governing party, probably going to be the main governing party for some time to come. And I think that the Conservatives in the rest of the world have got to look at them and say, how did this happen? Because we need to do the same thing.
There are interesting dilemmas in Canada, which are really across the Western world in terms of population. We have in Canada a dismally low birth rate. I know in Hungary, where your Danube Institute is headquartered, this has been an issue that has been really front and center for the government there. But it's not one we hear Western conservative leaders talking about. I've never heard Pierre Poilievre talk about birth rate. I've certainly never heard Rishi Sunak or Scott Morrison or any of these guys talk about it. So what can they learn from Orban's party, or even in general, some leaders that have taken up this question?
Well, you say that you haven't heard them talk about the birth rate. But you have heard them talk about immigration.
Yes, yes.
And those two issues are closely related. If you don't have, if you don't produce your own population, then other people are going to come in mm-hmm. to fill the gap. And I think that that's something which obviously has been most clearly realized by Viktor Orban, mm-hmm. But is also now being seen by British Conservatives looking at the prospective defeat and saying to themselves, look, we've made a mistake in trying to replace our own people who are more and more likely to be not working, to be receiving different forms of social and medical benefit, and retiring early. One of the themes of British life at the moment is where are our own people? Where do they go? They don't come to work anymore. Well, that's an exaggeration, mm-hmm. but there's obviously a trend there. So, so what I think now is happening is serious conservatives are saying, for some years now, we've been quite complacent about treating our own workers, offering them low wages. If they didn't take those low wages, we'd bring in cheap labor mm-hmm. to pay to do the work. And meanwhile, we would pay them through the welfare system one way or another to stay at home. That's not a sensible way to run a country. And that's obviously that's going to be the number one problem to face any government, mm-hmm. but particularly the Conservative Party in opposition. And remember, they're likely now to face another competitor on the right in the form of the Reform Party, the equivalent of the Canadian mm-hmm. Reformers. And that's going to make right-wing politics much livelier, much more competitive, and with competition, they're going to have to pay attention to their market. In other words, the people who vote for them. And I think they're going to have to turn to the issues that Reform is preaching, and the Conservative Party cannot really write those voters off.
I wanted to, on the note of the UK Tories, see if you could help demystify this, because every now and then people will send me something and say, oh, you won't believe what the UK Conservatives are doing, and I'd say, yes, I can believe it either way, yeah. But they've been very strong in some ways on resisting some of the transgender wokeness and on migration. Every now and then they say the right thing and do the right thing. It never seems to last. But then on the other hand, this is a party that went all in on the very worst aspects of the COVID era. It's a party that has gone all in on the very worst aspects of the climate discussion. And I'm wondering if you could explain this, how they can be so strong on some issues and so terrible on others. Maybe you reject the premise that they're not strong on any of them, which is an option.
No, I would say that the problem is in politics, when new ideas come forward, they often come in a deceptive guise as simply reasonable mm-hmm. attempts to deal with social problems. For example, the transgender issue is a very serious issue. And at first, if you didn't really look into it, anybody who said, look, these poor kids, their minds are in a mess because they think they're in the wrong body. Well, we have to really hand them over to the doctors and let them sort their way out to a mental health. And one way forward is to carry out, mm-hmm. give them drugs and so on. I think most people look upon this as a policy of kindness. That's the problem. The fact is, it is not kind. It is creating circumstances in which we encourage children to take actions in terms, or to accept actions by doctors in terms of drugs or in terms of surgery that are going to completely alter the rest of their life in ways that 5, 10, 15, 18-year-olds cannot conceivably understand. And that realization did not come quickly. And it hasn't come to everyone on the right or the left, mm-hmm. of course, to everyone still. But we are now realizing that this was a mistaken policy. And I think what's going to happen now is the Conservative Party is in a way that much more united way than before mm-hmm. is going to row back from that policy and look for ways of stabilizing and improving the mental health of these kids rather than encouraging a mass mania that is going to damage them.
And I understand you actually talk about woke. Well, you take on wokeness head on in your latest book, do you not?
Yes, I think I do. But taking wokeness head on is really not a question so much of attacking it as of trying to ascertain what it is and why it's a mistake. I mean, and there are so many different aspects. The identity crisis, one, nobody expected that when the identity became a subject of political interest, mm-hmm. that it would end up with political parties attempting to deny that there was such a thing as a woman, or yes. there was a clear distinction between a man and a woman, or saying that some women in the Labour Party who believed that a woman was an adult human female.
Just imagine when you were advising Margaret Thatcher, having to sit her down and say, "Now, Prime Minister, you have to come up with a position on what a woman is." Like, just that would have been such a foreign, laughable. That would have been a British telly sketch back then.
Well, it could have been exactly.
It might have actually been at
yeah.
the time.
I mean, it's a great pity that yes, Prime Minister didn't in mm-hmm. fact include that topic. I don't think it did, and I'd like to see a version in which it did. But common sense. Is obviously generally a guide to policy most of the time, but every now and then political manias occur, and indeed, in a way, my own view is that socialism, left socialism, is a kind of political mania, mm-hmm. and we're seeing that in British politics today, and indeed in American politics. When you have seen the actual consequences in practical life of socialism and communism, nobody in 1990 thought it would be a good idea to continue with communism. In the Soviet Union, you couldn't find a communist except in the party, and they were doing well out of it. So effectively, sometimes, and a very interesting example, when Burke originally denounced what was happening in the French Revolution, most of his fellow conservatives, Whigs and so on, they didn't agree with him. It was much too excessive, exaggerated. He was not demented exactly, but he was taking things much too seriously. A couple of years later, when heads started being chopped off and by the guillotine, they came round to seeing that he had realized from the very earliest stages where this kind of thing led. And essentially, that's a very common trend of events in politics. Wokery is now understood to be something that is dangerous. It has many, it's a hydra. It's mm-hmm. a beast with many dangerous heads. But obviously, one of them, transgenderism, is now coming under attack in a serious way from both doctors on the one hand, and also most recently from the Pope. Mm-hmm. And we don't think of the Pope as someone who rages on about this kind of thing.
No, and to the contrary, your my favorite book of yours from nearly two decades ago, The President, the Pope, and the Prime Minister, was of a pivotal time in history when the Pope was part of this force vanquishing yeah. communism, and the current Pope could learn. Perhaps he should read that book and see what he could be doing. Well, yeah. I look forward to reading the new book. John O'Sullivan from the Danube Institute, wonderful to have you on. Thank you so much.
Very nice to be here.
Thank
All
you,
the best,
John.
Andrew.
Yeah, really good to see you
Thank
as well.
You. Oh, let me give you the book.
Oh, you brought a prop. Okay. Sleepwalking into Wokeness, How We Got There. Well, hopefully through that we can learn to get out. Thank you very much, Sean. Always good to talk to you. Wait, is this signed, by the way?
No, but it will be.
Okay, it will be. All right, I'll give that back to you for now, and I'll pick it up after the show. Thank you very much, Sean. Always great to see John O'Sullivan. I must admit, last time I saw John, it was on a cruise ship, but he's always in fine form, so glad to have John back on the show. Now, you hear me quote all the time John O'Sullivan's first law, which is, I'm worried about misquoting it in his presence, but basically that any institution that's not explicitly right-wing will over time become explicitly left-wing. And what's phenomenal about that is how true it is. If you do not continue to swim upstream and continue to resist the currents that are trying to pull all of us in society and culture to the left, you will end up one of them. And that's so true of organizations. And by the way, so-called conservative parties are not immune to that. If you do not actively stay and remain a conservative Conservative Party, you will become a party that is indistinguishable from those on the left. So I want to bring it back home here. There is a bit of an Andrew Lawton Show tradition where every Monday we kick back with our good friend Chris Sims, who is the Alberta director for the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. But the conference didn't run Monday, so we did our Monday date with her, and we wanted to have her back on in the flesh on this Wednesday. We don't have the Chris Sims theme song with us, though, so perhaps she'll do a live rendition. But Chris, good to have you in person. Thanks
you
for coming.
Do not want me singing.
No, I don't. Is that, will that just make the numbers plummet down?
Yeah,
okay.
Don't do that.
All right. Disregard that. You can just pick it up from the show we did last week. But Chris, obviously the Canadian Taxpayers Federation here in full force. Your guy, we can't turn our cameras around, but you're right across there. You've got the Teddy Award, which is like the preeminent award for government waste. Do you like get to the point where you have too many nominees now?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So we call it, when we do our nominations each year, we call it the Battle Royal. I'm speaking outside of school here, so I hope it's okay with my boss. And the conference call lasts like 5 hours. Mm. And we all have to make our hard pitch for what we want to be for our region. So you have the municipal category, you have the Alberta category or provincial category, and then federal. And then there's lifetime achievement. Mm. And for the last few years, unfortunately, there's been so many nominees that it's a real fight to see who wins. And it is so much money being wasted. But yeah, Teddy is definitely a big highlight of the year.
You were obviously there this morning when I did the interview with New Brunswick Premier Brian Higgs. Tomorrow, I'm in your domain doing an interview with Premier Danielle Smith. What are the issues that you think, I mean, you can talk about Danielle Smith, or in general, provincial premiers should be tackling when they're at a forum like this, and you have that advantage of speaking to your movement faithful. This is the red meat group where you really can't try to be the whole winning over the CBC type.
Yeah, exactly. What I love about this conference and this forum is that you're speaking directly to your base, as mm-hmm. you point out well. But if you look carefully, there's also some press gallery journalists around
here.
Because it's right down the street. And so you're getting this alloy, really, of the grassroots red meat base and the fancy mm-hmm. people in the press gallery who can turn around and take that message up to Parliament Hill and pressure Trudeau to do things. And what I find fascinating is now I think it passed with almost all parties except for the Liberals pressuring Trudeau to have a conference on mm-hmm. the carbon tax. So that is huge. And so we're really happy to see that kind of movement. And we're really happy to see things like axing the tax really becoming a headline now. For a long time, people were just taking it on the chin. They were spending way too much money on this carbon tax, and now it's a headline item. And so we're really pleased to see that.
Yeah, I get somewhat pessimistic on these things when you have leaders like Pierre Poilievre, for example, that are constantly beating the drum on a particular issue, as the opposition leader is supposed to do. And you say, okay, what's the point of all of this? But at the same time, I will say, and a part of this, I think, is a Poilievre-specific thing, you see ways that he has had tremendous influence. One great example is the number of people I hear use the word gatekeepers now,
yes.
compared to even a couple of years ago. Like, this has actually become a word that has really been adopted into the political discourse beyond the conservative media. And some people use it ironically and as a joke, but people get that concept that, yeah, there are gatekeepers that are standing in the way of progress, development, of liberty, of all of these things.
Yes, exactly. People often joke about slogans, but slogans and icons matter because they're short mm-hmm. and they put an image in your mind and you remember them. It also really matters to tell a story and paint a picture. And while I'm really glad that he says things like axe the tax, because that sticks in your mind, it's very similar to a bumper sticker of scrap the tax. I like how he paints a picture as well, and he describes the Canadian yeah. family coming home to the home they can afford. And one of the best things I've ever heard in communications was from Maya Angelou, who said something to the effect of, people may not remember what you say, but they'll always remember how you made them feel.
Yes.
And he really had the room when he was describing that. He almost had himself. He got a little bit, tiny bit choked up if you look carefully mm-hmm. there. And so I find that messaging really important. And that's something that we try to do at the Taxpayers Federation. We take the numbers, yes, but we make it about a story. Right? Because, you know, you can say, oh, well, the carbon tax costs you $85 per ton. What's a ton? Honey, did you pick up a ton of carbon on the way home? Nobody knows what that means, but
yeah.
they sure know what it means if you spend...
They know what it means on a liter of gas.
That's right.
And they know what it means on the heating bill, right?
$13 per minivan.
Yeah.
It's $18 per pickup truck. $350 per winter.
That's how much the carbon tax is costing you. And I think that was really effective.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I deal with this stuff for a living. It was the same as when we were talking about wind turbines and people in Ontario. And people would make the argument, oh, is this, you know, kilowatt hours? That none of that matters to people. It's how much is it on their bill, on their energy bill, on their hydro bill? Because that's a number people have committed to memory. Everyone knows how much they spent at the grocery store, you know, spending $300 to get food for, you know, a family of four for just a few days. People know those numbers.
Exactly. I can get, so what it costs you to extra to fill up a pickup truck now, light duty. So if you're $18, I can get a roast chicken and a jug of milk for that. Mm-hmm. You're taking food out of my fridge and off of my table, and for no reason, right? Even if Canada ceased to exist, God forbid, if we stopped eating, we stopped heating our homes, we stopped driving, it wouldn't make a dent in global emissions. If we really want to fight global emissions, why don't we tackle the big end of the arithmetic problem? Mm-hmm. Again, as has been pointed out by so many panelists, and this was almost taboo to talk about these things five or six years ago. This was, you know, it was such a fait accompli. We had the former previous leader of the Conservative Party do a massive flip-flop and say, okay, a carbon tax is just fine. It sure isn't fine.
Yeah, I don't know where I can redeem my O'Toole bucks now, but we'll have to figure that out.
Your solar blender?
Yeah, exactly. I can buy an energy-efficient way home, so I can buy carbon offsets on my Air Canada flight with those O'Toole bucks. But you raised that point, and I think another area where I'd say events like this are valuable is always providing that baseline conservative position to say to any leader that thinks of doing that, whether it's Pierre Poilievre or Danielle Smith or anyone, no, we won't stand for that. I mean, because if you can't talk about conservative ideas around conservatives, you're never going to be able to talk about them anywhere else. And that was the problem with, I'd say, the Conservative Party in 2021, is that they didn't even really have an interest in cementing those base, unflappable, unshakable principles. So when they put out this platform and they get bad press from the media, it's easy to just say, oh, yeah, well, yeah, we changed our mind on that. It's like, well, it's laminated. Like, you printed it. Why are you changing your mind on your own platform? But it's easy to do that if you haven't actually committed to represent, I mean, largely the people that are in this room behind us.
Yeah, and I think there's a bunch of factors at play here. So you and I have both worked in mainstream media and in new and alternative and independent media, and the waning of the power of the mainstream media and thus of the press gallery, I think, has given some politicians the courage to kind of reach past them. Right, to reach past the gatekeeper, right, to use that term, and to speak directly to their base and have the confidence in it. And now they can have a direct email list, they can have a YouTube channel that's getting more views than the CBC. They can see in real time that they're getting their message through. Up until a few years ago, they would have been guessing if they had dared gone against the narrative and tried to vault that press gallery. Now they can see it. They can see it in the subscriptions, in the views, and in their donations.
Yeah. Very well said, Chris Sims. Great to see you in person.
Likewise.
I mean, I see you in person every now and then, but not on our regular Monday check-in. So.
I'm his official photographer.
Yeah, very vibrant as always, both in blazer and in demeanor. So, Chris Sims, thank you so much. We'll see you on Monday in the regular time, but it won't be like this anymore. So, all right. Well, with that, I will say to you all that concludes our program for today. We'll be back with a bonus Friday edition of The Andrew Lawton Show tomorrow in lieu of Off the Record. I hope you Off the Record loyalists won't mind, but we're preempting it just while we're here and we got the big fancy set up. But we will talk to you tomorrow in just 23 hours. Thank you, God bless, and good day to you all.
Thanks for listening to The Andrew Lawton Show. Support the program by donating to True North at www.tnc.news.